The Gates of Horn and Ivory, by Francis Rosenfeld. Chapter 5. The Thesmophoria, Part 3. To say that everybody woke up the next day nursing a headache would be an understatement. The wine and the herbs left a parting gift, a vicious nausea, amplified to epic levels by the main part of the ceremony. The Antlerii, the wailers, descended into the Megara pits, specially outfitted with snakes for the occasion, to retrieve decomposed pieces of the pig sacrifices, which were then placed on the altars to be blessed by the goddess, and then taken home, as they were believed to offer bounty and protection to the crops when buried in the fields. The only silver lining of the previous day's overindulgence was one couldn't be sure anymore whether the smell of rotten meat was real or the result of a massive hangover. Through the headaches and bleary-eyed confusion of the morning after, the celebrations continued, however, libations, dances, obscene language and all, and actually helped the participants feel better, because it provided them with a cure in the guise of the hair of the dog that bit them. The third day was all about fertility, and honoring Calligenia, the goddess of childbirth, for protecting those in labor, nursing mothers, and the well-being of their infants. They never missed out on enlisting Demeter and Persephone's help in the matter as well, since childbirth, the most perilous endeavor any woman would ever go through, and which cost so many their lives, needed all the help it could get. For this reason, Demeter's symbols of fertility, the snake, the pig, the pinecone, the egg, the pomegranate, the grains, artifacts depicting the male and female genders, but most of all, her favorite treats, barley cakes sweetened with honey, were never missing from her altars. The celebrations continued until early afternoon, when the foods left from the feast were donated to the poor and the women went back to their homes to resume their modest roles of wives and mothers, while Persephone and Demeter made their way back to Olympus for a well-deserved rest. Bittersweet feelings overcame Persephone, driven by the preparations for returning to her husband, her mother's sadness, the overwhelming whirlwind of activities, but most of all, the group of lost souls she had gathered around her and secured to herself, which were all sad and lost. A very disorienting feeling for the goddess, who bathed in their unfettered emotions, pulled in contradicting directions and crying at a drop of a hat. Her mother didn't help, of course, since her waterworks were simply impossible to keep in check at this time, evenly distributed to cover the times before and after her daughter's departure. The day before she left, Persephone loosened the bonds of the waters, to release rain and fertility, by spilling two large vessels filled with water towards the east and the west. With this she sealed again the pact between the heavens and the earth, and the promise of a bountiful harvest, a marriage of sorts, not unlike her own, if she stopped to think about it. It was already very cold, and she wasn't used to the chill of winter anymore. The opening of the jugs to taste the new wine helped a little, but it was time for her to go home, to Hades, although she always avoided the word home in relation to the underworld, as not to irritate her mother. In the bustle of sowing and harvest and blessings of marriage and children and fertility and womanhood she had very little time to herself, but during the few moments of quiet contemplation she missed Hades, and the peace of her home, her beautiful gardens, and if she wanted to be honest, being an all-powerful queen. On earth she would forever be her mother's daughter, and although she felt comforted by the doting and attention of the latter, she continued to be treated like a child who needed a grown-up to guide her in every way. She could never command the respect and authority she had been given, as queen of one-third of reality. Sweet, delicate, and innocent as she looked, Persephone was an almighty goddess with power over life and death, over people and the world of plants, and in her home in the underworld she wielded that power in the absolute, being both loved and feared by her subjects, whose fates she decided. Few people ever pondered this, but all the wealth of the world actually came from Hades, the useful and precious metals, the gems, the crops, the soft stone for erecting temples and statues, the coal for the fires. The underworld was an embarrassment of riches, which Persephone administrated with confidence and skill, like the grown-up goddess she really was. For all the people who knew her as a young girl, she had remained stuck at that age, and because, like all the gods, she didn't age, they assumed she was the same naive girl she was back then, not the mature and authoritative queen she had become. It could be frustrating at times, but her maturity and experience brought with them the wisdom to accept the things she couldn't change, and the patience to bear misunderstandings, faulty assumptions, and unsolicited advice. She had a sudden craving for pomegranates, the sweet and fragrant ones that grew in her grove. Of all the riches of the underworld, contentment and peace were the ones she found priceless. Nobody in the world of the living was ever satisfied. No matter what they had, they always wanted better, more, different. An exhausting chasing after the wind and looking over the fence to covet other people's gardens. A more dynamic experience, to be sure, and one enjoyable at times, if one didn't mind the monster hangovers and the exasperating indignity of the blood sacrifices. Even the gods couldn't escape this affliction of the spirit, the endless coveting of what they didn't have, and always looked for ways to one-up each other, constantly engaged in ego-driven feuds and empty dalliances. She closed her eyes to enjoy the beauty of her beloved gardens, whose image appeared into her mind with crystal clarity. She spent a little time there, assessing the well-being of the trees and making lists of tasks that needed to be done. She wondered why she never added that gazebo she always wanted, and planned to organize having one built as soon as she felt well-rested. The trip back to the underworld was always long and tiring, no matter what route she took. This year, she decided to go back through Tenerum, so she wouldn't have to add crossing the Adriatic on a ship to an already lengthy journey. Hades was going to feel rather empty with the departure of 2,000 souls, something else to get used to, but she refused to get sad. People seemed to like it better above ground. This commute of hers, between worlds, took its toll each year, when she had to readjust to living in one place or the other, and on her first days back she saw her life disconnected and surreal, like experiencing a vivid dream. Both life and death were dreams from which one could not wake up. One could only trade one for the other until the end of time. She couldn't help wonder what was outside this endless wheel of life, and if anyone ever managed to get off it, because, for all she knew, nobody did, not even the gods. The only thing she was sure was coming from outside of it were the figments from the land of dreams, which seemed to materialize out of nothing and disappear into nothing without warning, but which looked, felt, and acted as solid and believable as anything else around them between these defining events. What differentiates a true dream from a deceiving one if neither one is real? If reality was nothing but a dream, it was nice enough for her, and she was grateful for the blessings the Moiri saw fit to shower upon her, most of all an existence filled with love and purpose, acting in good balance with each other. The truth remained that having two real homes, as both her mother and her husband insisted she did, was the same as having no real home at all. That was the sacrifice required of her, and one she reluctantly accepted, to live in two worlds and not really belong in either. This year the journey back would be more difficult than normal, because she was taking home an unusually large number of souls, all confused, scared or angry, who were constantly vying for her attention. She could sense them everywhere now in the chaotic meanderings of flames, in the mournful sounds of the rain, out of the corner of her eyes, as passing shadows. She could feel the gate to the underworld was open, eagerly awaiting her return. She was looking forward to see herself relieved of her spiritual labor, after all the lost souls had been granted forgetfulness and peace, so she could wander quietly into the Hall of Hypnos and snuggle on one of those comfortable benches with silk-upholstered pillows for a well-earned and much-needed nap. She knew, however, that right now, in the underworld, a feast was being prepared to celebrate her return, a monumental celebration which, as queen, she was bound by ceremony to attend, and during which she wouldn't have a single moment alone with her husband, and at that feast she was going to be presented with all the tasks that had been piling up in her absence, all of which awaited her return to sort them out. She couldn't tell the dwellers of the living world who had a visceral abhorrence of all the beings of the underworld, but she dearly missed Cerberus, her faithful puppy, and was gleefully anticipating his antics. Funny how your familiarity becomes your normal, your safety and your standard of beauty. She was willing to bet some being from the oceanic realm found kittens absolutely terrifying.